This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
I got
rhythm.
I got
music.
I got
my gal, who could ask for anything more? Who could ask for anything more? I found somebody, kid!
Back in 1951, Gene Kelly danced his way through George Gershwin's score as Jerry Mulligan in the film An American in Paris.
Say the time step.
He's a GI at the end of World War II who has decided to stick around Paris and become an artist and falls in love with a ballerina who's got other plans. Now a new stage production takes Gershwin's score and puts the dancing totally front and center, as I'm not sure I've ever seen before in a Broadway musical. And last week, it was nominated for 12 Tony Awards. And I don't think I've ever seen a Broadway show of any kind that moves more seamlessly or gracefully, which is the work of the director and choreographer, Christopher Wheeldon. He's 41, and he already has had a long career as a star performer and even bigger star choreographer. Christopher Wheeldon, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
As a kid, I read that you were a Gene Kelly fan, as well as a Gershwin, introduced to Gershwin at 7.
I was introduced to Gershwin at 7. My parents took me to a concert. I threatened to sleep. And, of course, I was on the edge of my seat for the whole show. And I was a big fan of the American movie musical. Living in, you know, rural England in the days when there were still only 3 TV channels.
Yes.
It was a big deal when one of those big movies came on, yes, on the screen.
So for listeners who aren't familiar with An American in Paris, describe the love story between Jerry and Lise.
Well, we set our story right back at the moment of the liberation of Paris. So when they meet sort of amid the city, very low in confidence, really trying sort of desperately to kind of pull itself back from this devastating period. So it's sort of this incredibly beautiful moment of love kind of emerging from darkness.
The way you've used Gershwin's score is interesting as well. I want to play a bit from his American in Paris suite. Instead of making this the overture for the show, you use it near the end in this ballet, this show within the show, that you stage in a very stylized way. It looks like abstract art of the period.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, it was sort of around the time of that Balanchine was emerging as,
yes,
a great choreographer. Of course, the Ballet Russe. So it's an abstract ballet, and it's the sort of culmination of all of our principal characters' art forms crashing together at the end of the show. And at the heart of it is the moment when Jerry and Lise finally get to come together, and it's sort of the romantic climax. And there's this sort of extended duet where she sort of conjures him up. It's liquid romance, this.
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
Trumpet line is maybe the most romantic, sexy line ever written in classical music. And so it was about finding a way to make a sort of grounded, earthy, sinuous, kind of sweaty movement using the classical ballet vocabulary.
There is great dancing in the show, but these people really have to sing in a great way. And here is Robert Fairchild, who plays Jerry, singing.
Gosh, I'm fortunate. This thing we've begun is much more than a pastime. For this time is the one where the first time is the last time. I've got beginner's luck, lucky through and through. For the first time that I'm in love with you.
So finding great dancers who can really sing and who can act, there's a lot of just plain acting, must have been incredibly difficult. How did you do that?
It was a search, for sure. I mean, there's a bit of a history on Broadway of ballet dancers going into shows and, you know, everybody is impressed by their dancing, but kind of, oof, shame about the voice, or not quite there. And
yeah.
And Robbie was always in the back of my mind. I'd worked with him at City Ballet. So I had a hunch that he would be our guy, but I made him go through it. He auditioned for me several times, and we went to a lot of other people too.
You did a run of the show before it came to New York and Paris. Did you make changes for the American audience?
Oh, yes, we did.
Like?
We took about 23 minutes off the running time from Paris.
Wow, that's a lot. And they were objective, this just isn't working for an audience? Or were they, the French got this, but Americans won't? Or?
It was a little bit of a combination of the two, actually. We all felt that the show played really well in Paris, and the French audiences tend to, you know, they tend to sit longer. And maybe it's because musical theatre is more of a novelty there. I don't know. And then, of course, the jokes that landed in Paris didn't necessarily land here. And so that was then we worked on the script.
Having been a very successful choreographer for 15 years and not having been the director must have been scary, because there are all kinds of skills. You may, it's adjacent, but they aren't the same.
Yeah, I sweat even talking about it. The reading actually for me was the most terrifying part of the experience, because we were all, you know, put into a room for 4 days. And at the end of it, it was sort of the first test of whether the script was going to work and whether I was going to be able to direct these guys. And so day one, you know, no one was moving. They were all just sitting there looking at me with their scripts open. I'm thinking, okay, this is definitely outside of my comfort zone.
You danced from the time you were a very little boy, and then you were in the Royal Ballet at 16, and then the New York City Ballet, and then, which must have totally shocked everybody, at 28 you retired.
Yeah.
Talk about that decision.
Well, you know, I was sort of at the end of all of these great choreographers' lives. When I was a student at the school in London, I saw the end of Frederick Ashton's life. And then I joined the Royal Ballet and I worked for a couple of years with Sir Kenneth McMillan, who was, you know, another of the great choreographers. And then he passed away. And I was like, okay, well, who's still around that I could work with? Because I just felt like I kept missing my chance, in a sense, to work with these greats. And Balanchine was already gone. And Jerome Robbins was still alive and working at the New York City Ballet. And, you know, through sort of a twist of fate, I was fascinated in American dance. I danced a Balanchine ballet for my graduation performance in London, and it felt like suddenly I was wearing clothing that actually fit me. Hmm. So there were several reasons why I came to New York, but to work with Robbins was sort of a primary reason.
What did you learn from him?
I learned a great deal from him. First, I worked with him on the abstract ballet repertoire of his. And what was interesting was, even when Jerry was abstract, so even when we were out there and we weren't actually portraying characters, he encouraged us to find a character for ourselves and to relate to our fellow dancers.
Really? So kind of write your own story?
Write your own story. And then, of course, you know, working on West Side Story Suite, he challenged us as ballet dancers in a way that we'd never been challenged before. He would say, just on the spot, he'd suddenly, you know, point at a dancer and say, you know, who are you? Where are you from? What's your, you know, how many brothers do you have? So you had to sort of really invest in your character. So, you know, I was, a 22-year-old English boy from the southwest of England, and suddenly I'm having to kind of come up with an American name, where I live in New York City.
And did you had your story, I presume.
I had
you
my
obeyed
story.
Mr. Robbins.
I obeyed Mr. Robbins. I did. He yelled at me once because, you know, there's the famous rumble scene in West Side Story where we actually all have to vocalize, and he gave us a bunch of things to say. And there was just one particular rehearsal where everyone's kind of, you know, Bernardo and Riff are about to attack each other and everyone's shouting. And suddenly, for some reason, everyone went quiet and I came out with, "Cut him like a fish." And there was just this sort of dead silence. And he was like, what are you saying? In that terrible, terrible English accent.
You're not a jet.
You're not a jet. Yeah, no.
That's very funny. And had you always, or not always, but from some adolescent moment or in your 20s thought, I really am going to be a choreographer. I'm not going to become something else altogether when I stop dancing?
Yeah, it felt as natural a progression for me as being an eight-year-old standing outside the gates of the Royal Ballet School with my parents in London and saying, I want to go there. You know, it was, and I was choreographing from a very early age. I had teachers at school that encouraged it. And
really? Like at 12, you're choreographing?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to see that.
Yeah, I choreographed a piece to Leroy Anderson's The Syncopated Clock.
Oh, of course.
When I was
famous.
When I was 11 years old.
Which all our listeners would recognize if we played it now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I remember it was selected from a group of 6 or 7 little pieces to be performed for Princess Margaret. And that was, you know, it's like,
really?
It's like anything in those years growing up. If you get that little boost of confidence, then you start to think, oh,
for sure,
maybe I'm good at that.
Good scene in the biopic with Princess Margaret watching.
Yeah.
Your work, especially An American in Paris, is so lush and lyrical. But you've also created, for instance, this work, Polyphonia, which has a score by Ligeti, which is atonal and quintessentially modernist. I want to play a little bit of that. So turning that into a dance, was that just like, okay, I can do this too, a personal challenge?
It was kind of a masochistic moment in my life because I grew up loving romantic, lush scores of, you know, Debussy and Poulenc. And so, you know, I got to a point where I was like, okay, I need to push myself. Let's like find the scariest piece of music I can and see what I can do with it. And I found this album of Ligeti's music at Tower Records, which is where I used to go and listen to the listening stations to pick. That's how I picked my music.
That sounds like something of a person older than you. I didn't know there were still listening stations when you were going to Tower Records.
There were still listening stations. And so I found this music and I was fascinated by it and terrified of it. And I thought, okay, well, this is the right piece to really have a go. And it sort of unlocked this sort of interest in atonal music.
Uh-huh. You had your own company with your name in it that you ran for a few years until 2010. How was that experience on balance?
It was fascinating. It was great having the experience of building something from the ground up. We unfortunately announced the company and then the entire economy just sort of crashed.
2007 to 2010, not a perfect time start a thing.
No, not a perfect time to be asking people for money.
Yeah.
And that's in the end, that's why it sort of broke down for me, because I was spending more time searching for dancers and fundraising than I was in the studio. And those just really aren't my gifts. My gift is in the room with with the bodies and with the music.
Yeah. When George Balanchine created his production of The Nutcracker 60-odd years ago, he was 51, and he danced in it. So are you done? Have you hung up the shoes, or are you going to do it again?
I have hung up the shoes. I did a fundraising gala in London about 4 years ago, and I hadn't been on stage for about 7 years, and it was a really uncomfortable experience. I thought I would love it, and I got myself back into really, really good dancer shape, but actually it was the nerve suddenly of just... I felt like an imposter, because you build through the years, you build the confidence to be out on stage and it feels like home, and suddenly it just didn't feel like home at all.
Does that make you sad?
Not really, because I perform every day in the studio when I'm creating. That's now become my performance. By showing dancers what to do and feeling the movement in my body. Nobody needs to pay to see that anymore.
I'm sure some in the dance world would pay a great deal to see that. That's a webcast you can begin. Christopher Wheeldon, it has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
An American in Paris is on Broadway right now. And it's just been nominated for 12 Tony Awards.